This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 400, was produced on November 2nd, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Commodity Context founder Rory Johnston returns to talk all things crude oil in this week's feature interview. We'll discuss everything from predictions of massive supply shortfalls in Q3 and Q4 that didn't quite happen as expected, to geopolitical escalation risk in the Israel-Gaza conflict, to the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. The S&P 500 December futures were up 112 basis points, closing at 4256. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 12 basis points, closing at 106.67. The December WTI crude oil contract down 580 basis points, closing at 80.44. We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The December RBOB gasoline down 372 basis points to 219. The December gold contract down 45 basis points to 1987, bumping along the 2000 round number. Will be interesting to see if we get further breakouts. Copper futures up 167 basis points, closing at 365. Short-term bounce higher, but far from a meaningful trend reversal. Uranium up 95 basis points, closing at 74.45, once again pressing to new multi-year highs. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield down 23 basis points, closing at 4.73. Yields rejecting 5%. It will be interesting to see if bonds are begin establishing a bottom. The key news to watch this week is Friday's jobs numbers and the ISM services PMI. Next week, we have a slow week on the economic news front with the University of Michigan consumer sentiment numbers and really the tail end of earnings season. This week's feature interview guest is Rory Johnston, founder and CEO of CommodityContext.com. Eric, why did we invite Rory back as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, as our regular listeners know, I've been expressing a very non-consensus view. I'm just a whole lot more concerned about geopolitical escalation threatening global oil supply and potentially creating a very significant upside risk to oil prices. Seems like almost nobody else agrees with that, and I kind of feel a responsibility to get more oil experts on the show to balance my own views, because I know a lot of listeners do follow my views, and you know, I want you to hear the other side of the story. And no surprise, Rory is going to agree with some of our other past guests that he thinks I've got this risk situation a little bit blown out of proportion. So maybe it's just me, but let's see what Rory has to say in this interview. I think you're really going to enjoy this one.
Well, Eric's interview with Rory Johnston is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Rory Johnston, founder and CEO of CommodityContext.com. Rory, it's great to get you back on the show. Our listeners often hit us up on Twitter asking us to get you back on to talk about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So let's try and hit that at the end of today's interview. But what I want to start with is the question of supply imbalance. Everybody who's anybody in the crude oil business, from Goldman Sachs to JP Morgan to a whole bunch of other analysts, back last summer, they all predicted there was going to be a massive supply shortfall to the tune of 3 million barrels a day in Q3 and Q4. And everyone thought that that was going to send crude oil prices substantially higher. Well, that started to happen at the beginning of Q3, but here we are in the middle of Q4, and it seems to have faded away completely, or at least that's what the EIA data seemed to indicate. So what happened, Rory? Why didn't the predicted shortfall show up in the data?
Well, so this is the strange thing that's happening right now. So I run my own global oil demand and supply balances as well, just to kind of give myself a sanity check on these estimates put out by the big outlets. And my data is also showing very considerable deficits, at least since May and June, and continuing right through to August and September, where the last data I have is kind of tabulated for. So the balances, like the deficits, are there in the data, but I think it's pretty reasonable to say that no one looks at the market right now and says it's a market that looks like it's 3 million barrels a day in deficit. So I think there's probably a couple places where you begin to see leakage away from that, call it paper deficit, to a real tangible deficit in the market. I'm sure we'll talk more about Iran later, but I think, you know, looking at a couple easy examples, understated Iran production levels, I think, are one area where you could probably get, you know, 200,000, 300,000 barrels a day of extra balance on the supply side. I think China is a massive question right now. I think Chinese demand looks exceptionally flabbergastingly strong, which definitely seems to, well, one, seems to be holding up the entire demand artifice of the world at the moment. But on the other side, it does definitely seem to be running kind of orthogonal to the broader macroeconomic data and narrative we're seeing coming out of China, you know, vis-a-vis the economic slowdown, the issues in real estate, and kind of the traditional heavy industry sector. So I think all of that, all I'm trying to say here is that these supply-demand balances that we all love so much, as you were saying, are useful tools. But I think when you see realized, you know, outcomes in the market differ considerably from what you'd expect in the balances, you can kind of look and say, like, okay, something's wrong. And you begin to start, you know, questioning and kind of troubleshooting, essentially, like, what's wrong with the model? And I think, you know, you have to kind of look through all those things and the questions around, you know, where are the biggest question marks? Well, you have things like that China demand and Venezuela, sorry, Iranian supply. You also have stuff around things like we know, for instance, that EIA data, which is a kind of a constant kind of talking point in the market, this crude oil supply adjustment, which was very, very large, and particularly in the weekly data that everyone follows so closely. But I think the first thing that's important to note is that a positive, you know, crude oil supply adjustment in and of itself, people always talk about it as this bullish factor, but it is definitively a bearish factor. It means that the data you're seeing, the data we include in our models, is either understating supply or overstating demand. And I think most likely, and what the EIA's own investigations have found, is a little bit of both. What you've already seen in their data, so when they looked into this, the two major factors they identified as driving this crude oil supply adjustment higher were, one, basically an understating of blending demand or barrels of natural gas liquids that were effectively being counted as crude, either in exports or in input into refineries. And the other thing is essentially an understatement of, so basically you were overstating demand because this blending demand wasn't really demand. It was just kind of coming back into the supply side. So what they did was create this transfers to crude oil supply column in their balances. And this has reduced demand in particular by about 600,000 or 700,000 barrels a day, which I think is, again, these big chunks notably go towards closing that balance and making this data make more sense, especially since these adjustments exploded more recently. So they're going to have a larger impact on kind of more recent data. The other thing that we still know is that that was only part of it. And they've begun adjusting that in the monthly data, and they will begin trickling through to the weekly data in December. But then there's also this question of this understated production. They'll probably have kind of maybe 300,000 barrels a day more there, where that will begin to be, you know, upgraded in go forward. They're planning in March, I believe. So those are a couple of things that you start to, you know, whittle away that balance. But I think the bizarre thing is that even all that together, it still looks like a reasonably tight market on paper. And it looks like a reasonably tight market if you're looking at things like calendar spreads. Not quite as tight as we were at the kind of peak of prices at the end of September, but still, you know, very backwardated. You know, Brent today is trading at like $1.25 a barrel versus, you know, prompt versus second month. WTI is a little bit weaker, but still in that kind of clearly backwardated area. And I think, you know, inventories, like you were saying, total petroleum inventories aren't as hot as you would have expected, but crude inventories continue, you know, to decline or at least range trade sideways when they should be building at this time of year in the U.S. data. So it looks like the crude oil is tight. It looks like the diesel market is reasonably tight, but you then have these like pockets of very weak conditions in natural gas liquids, in gasoline, et cetera. So it's a very, very messy market. But I think it's, you know, looking at everything, it still looks like crude is at least reasonably tight, even if it's not 3 million barrel a day tight.
It seems to me that if your independent analysis checks with what Goldman and JP Morgan and everybody else said about there being a big supply deficit based on all the data that were available to you, Well, then somebody must be monkeying with the data that's being fed to you and to Goldman. And I think, well, Iran is the obvious target, but there's no way that Iran, you know, is gray market selling an extra 3 million barrels that we don't know about because they don't produce that much. So the next target that, I mean, I don't understand what the motive could be, but it seems like China clearly has a massive SPR. If they have, as Dr. Anas Al-Haji predicted on this show just a few weeks ago, he thought as prices started to get up that China would start drawing down its SPR. If they've been drawing down their SPR but not telling the world that's what they're doing, that might explain it. But what would their motive be for doing that?
I think China is the natural place to look, and specifically, like you're saying, in China, looking at strategic rather than commercial stocks. The commercial stocks we do have access to in China look pretty normal, very similar to what you see in the US and European data. But, you know, the fundamental challenge that everyone needs to understand about Chinese, particularly demand data, is it doesn't actually report monthly demand data like all the rest of the world does. It reports production, and then you have implied trade data. So you can kind of create these implied or apparent Chinese demand numbers, and those really, really rocketed. And again, you know, you're looking at huge, like 2 million barrel a day, year to date demand growth implied in China, which is a staggering amount. That is more than the entire, that's about 2/3 of global demand growth this year. That's a huge number. Putting China in, you know, over 17 million barrels of demand a day for the first time in its real history for like four, five, 6 months running now. So I wrote a while back, and I think this is the clearest, most likely culprit for some weirdness that we're seeing in the data, just because it's such a big piece of the puzzle. It's like almost a fifth of the global market, and it's, you know, notoriously opaque with what it presents. I wrote a little while back on Commodity Context, a post called, you know, Chinese Demand Doubts. And in that, I posited essentially a theory that, you know, early in the COVID crisis, you saw China take advantage of very, very low global prices and began, you know, and this is something that China does a lot with commodities. When prices are low, it stock builds. It loves to build these strategic stocks. I used to cover metals a lot more than I do now, and they did this all the time with base metals, copper, et cetera. So you always have these state reserves of all these commodities. But you saw it in crude early in COVID. But what I'm seeing is coming is being implied as strategic building on the refined product side. So either you are seeing kind of record demand in China across a whole bunch of areas, or you're seeing that difference, that surplus to actual need going into, you know, strategic stocks. And we're talking like big implied flows, if that's true, like 500,000 or to a million barrels a day on some of those highest months. And the rationale for that, you know, yeah, this is where we get into speculative territory. It seems unlikely that they're building that much refined product, and particularly diesel inventories, when diesel prices are so high. It just seems way too high to be pure, normal economic stock building. The other question, you know, the other argument or answer would be that it's like pure national security strategic, like very, very old school, you know, war and peace strategic stock building, in which case there is an argument that we had seen over the past year increasing signs of hostility between Beijing and Taiwan. If you were to see China begin to prepare for an increase or an escalation in hostilities that could disrupt flows of commodities into China, this is kind of what you'd expect to see. You know, they've already filled their crude reserves up. Now they're going to start building some products as well. And The Economist had a really interesting piece looking at other commodities like the agricultural commodities and other things that they were building at the same time, just seemingly bizarrely strong stock building demand given the price and kind of overall market structure at the time. So I think while it still seems like a very low probability that this is, I'm suspicious when you come to like they're planning war. But the data is such that I can't completely rule it out. The alternative is that China is indeed consuming just a gobsmacking volume of petroleum products right now, and entirely separate from its overall macro story, which seems equally interesting and bizarre to me if that's the case.
Returning to the EIA data, you already mentioned the adjustment, which I found absolutely fascinating. You know, if you take a freshman accounting class and your trial balance doesn't work and you just add something at the end that just you know, fudges it and changes it to what you want it to be, you don't pass the freshman accounting class. But EIA seems to be exempt from that. They just, you know, change the numbers after the fact and say, trust us. I want to talk, though, about Cushing, Oklahoma specifically, because back in the day, we used to think Cushing was absolutely critical because that's where the WTI futures contract is settled. If there's not enough oil in Cushing, people could put a squeeze on that. You could get into a physical delivery situation that could really disrupt the market. These days, with exchange for physical rules in the futures market, they don't really have to settle the actual physical oil at the location of Cushing, Oklahoma anymore. So how important is it? You know, we're basically at what some people have described as virtual tank bottoms, 20 million barrels of oil in storage in Cushing. A lot of people say that's kind of like the bare minimum that the place can operate on. How critical is that to the market, and what are the things that go wrong? Is it blending operations? I mean, if you have less than this, you know, suppose we got down to 10 million, what would break? Is it you can't do blending at that point, or what breaks?
Well, I think you're definitely right. I mean, the number one most important thing, I think one of the things that's fascinating with the history of Cushing and why the U.S. WTI, kind of the main crude hub, is in Oklahoma rather than, I think, what most people would expect it today to be like on the Gulf Coast of Texas. Why is it in Oklahoma? And I think the bizarre thing is that, you know, the history of the United States as a major crude oil importer, and particularly up into areas like the Midwest, is that, you know, you'd import the crude into, you know, the Gulf Coast, into PADD 3, then you ship it north. So what you've seen since then is between the, you know, continued growing of the Canadian oil sands. I'm Canadian up in Toronto. And then in addition, you also had obviously the shale revolution. You had this massive, you know, move of oil both in, you know, the mid-continent, as well as obviously in Texas, and began to shift the entire flow of everything. And now you even have Canadian barrels being exported at the U.S. Gulf Coast, whereas historically they would all be kind of trapped and captive in the PADD 2 Midwest market. So that's entirely shifted. And now the main locus is shifting from Cushing towards, and even from the Cushing primary WTI contract, to much more this kind of, you know, Houston WTI or Midland delivered to Houston ports or kind of broader Gulf Coast ports. And now that this is because WTI Midland has been included in the Brent blend, the first non-North Sea crude to be included. So yeah, you're shifting the entire balance of interest and function in the market away from Cushing and down towards the Gulf Coast. I'm not an expert on the kind of the specific concerns around blending in Cushing. But I do know that the reason you have large stocks of inventories in a major hub like that is that it's even, you know, there's the very, very bare kind of maintenance requirement, but the majority of it's there that if you even have a minor disruption, you have a cushion there so that you can maintain normal operations. So as an example, last year we saw a kind of a multi-week outage on the Keystone pipeline. That would have a much larger impact on the market if you went into that situation with already very, very low Cushing stocks, because you just have that much less time to kind of, you know, float in your own kind of buffer there. And I think generally what you've seen overall is that, you know, these tighter stocks, and again, they're tighter in Cushing, they're tighter in the Gulf Coast, they're tighter kind of everywhere across the United States. And that is making the overall system, theoretically at least, more sensitive to moves in supply and demand. Although, as a kind of we've seen in the market, you know, crude is trading back down to, you know, trading off of its highs now. So again, it's the market should be tighter than it is. And I'll acknowledge here that I am reasonably bullish at these prices, just given all of the risks on the horizon. But obviously, the market is relatively sanguine despite those risks at this point.
Let's move on to geopolitical risks. I seem to be the odd man out here. I think there's a very high risk, upside risk in price to the oil market, because I think it's likely that we're going to see an escalation to some kind of kinetic conflict with Iran. A lot of people who are more knowledgeable than I am disagree with me on that. What's your view on that, and how do you see the geopolitics in general playing out and as it affects the oil market?
Let's just narrow the conversation very specifically to what's going on in the Middle East right now, because I think there's, you know, over the past year, geopolitics has generally meant Russia. That file has kind of quieted down, or, you know, we could have been talking about China and Taiwan a couple months ago, and that's less of a concern today than it was a couple months ago. And now the main focus is war in the Middle East and further escalation. So on, you know, obviously on October 7th, when the Israel-Hamas war began with Hamas's heinous assaults against Israeli citizens, this was the kind of environment that theoretically there's no more classic risk premium that we discuss in markets than, you know, political or security instability in the Middle East and with a direct feed through to crude oil prices. It's like, that's like the textbook definition of risk premium in the market. And I think that what you're seeing today is that, and the Palestinian territories do not have a substantial impact on the market themselves. The two ways that this could and theoretically would impact the market is through proxy relationships and broader geopolitics in the region, specifically as they apply to Iran, most notably, and then Saudi Arabia. I think it's important that we kind of break those out separately. In the case of Iran, I think this is what most people think about when they think about the kind of primary risk of escalation, with the ultimate example of a blockade or a mining of the Strait of Hormuz by Tehran, which would have obviously a huge impact on the market and is one of the ultimate tail risks in every scenario planning exercise I've ever been aware of in the oil market. But I think that it is reasonably unlikely. I think that at this stage, you know, they would be dramatically shooting yourself in the foot and your kind of primary, and I'm speaking from the perspective of Iran here, you know, you'd be shooting yourself in the foot and removing your primary lifeline in this market, which is China. And I think it seems unlikely to me that Tehran would cut the 1.5 million plus barrels a day it's shipping to China out of its kind of relationship. I don't think China would like that, particularly what we're talking about with, earlier about a clear kind of stock building and security bias in Beijing. At the same time, it obviously wouldn't help the case of Iran, and it would obviously spark a massive immediate retaliation from the United States directly in the area. And I think that seems, well, not impossible by any means. Anything can happen in the oil market forever and always. It's certainly a tail risk. And I don't think it's anywhere near a base case for me. But I think that where you will likely see some erosion of Iranian supply to the market is one of the major things we've been following this year is surging Iranian exports, despite the fact there has been no official change in U.S. and White House sanctions policy towards Iran. So what's been going on, and the major discussion point and the phrase that people are using is this idea of like looser sanctions enforcement, despite there being no letter of the law change. Now, if you saw an explicit, and some people I think have been mistaken in saying that there's been like an actual easing of sanctions. If that was the case, you would see a lot of Iran's old customers, countries like India, coming back into the market in size. And that just hasn't been the case. What you've seen is the buyers of sanctioned Iranian crude have just been buying more of it. And by buyers of Iranian crude, I mostly mean China. So what's been going on? I think the main discussion here is that the White House and the Biden administration has very clearly been trying to get Iran back to the negotiating table and back to a discussion and back in some kind of deal like the JCPOA or more colloquially the Iran deal that was scuttled by the Trump administration. That's kind of a clear point that the Biden administration has been in favor of for a very long time. And earlier this year, there was a notable chilling warming of rhetoric around Iran. And I think what this did was it signaled to Chinese or potential Chinese buyers that there's always some risk to buying Iranian crude, but that risk shifts with how the U.S. is kind of signaling its intention to enforce those sanctions on the books. So what I think we saw was that they were kind of saying, like, this is not the moment in these negotiations that we're going to like make a very high profile, sanctions busting endeavor. That manifested as 500 to 700,000 barrels more Iranian crude in the market, right now than there was a year ago. It was one of the largest sources of global supply growth over the past year. And I think that was a very notable change in the market. Because there was no official change in U.S. sanctions policy towards Iran, it's really, really hard to say, like, okay, since the Israel-Hamas war started and, there's a clear question, a clear dotted line between Tehran and Hamas, and particularly between Tehran and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, this is the question of, like, what would they do? Would they directly say, we're ramping up sanctions? Well, no, because then they would have to acknowledge that they loosened sanctions enforcement in the first place, and the official line is that they haven't done that. So what I think is one of those things that you're only going to be able to see as the data progresses. And what I would expect to see is, despite no change in sanctions, I would expect to see less Iranian exports into the market, just because you're going to be that, potential buyers are that much more concerned that you're going to have kind of US sanctions enforcement coming on the back of this, hotter tone with Tehran. So I think that's the big question. I think this, while I think a total shuttering of the Strait of Hormuz is still very tail risk, I think a 500,000 barrel a day plus loss of Iranian exports is very within the realm of, if not base case, even just like, high probability kind of hawkish case.
Now, I have to confess, I am in the base case camp in terms of something very significant happening in Iran. So I'd like to just ask you a little more about this, because I'm clearly the odd man out, and most people agree with you. So most experts agree with you. But I guess what I'm missing is, it seems to me the logic that I'm hearing from everybody goes kind of like this. Look, the U.S., for the sake of deterrence, just moved two aircraft carrier battle groups and a whole bunch of guided missile destroyers and cruisers into the region to create this massive deterrent that Iran would be absolutely crazy to try and attack Israel now, because what they would be bringing down upon themselves would be just so incredible that nobody's that stupid. And I think, wait a minute. How did we get into this in the first place? Hamas did something which clearly was certain to bring this incredible wrath down upon them. The intel that the U.S. government is telling us that it believes is that Iran was at least partially behind that Hamas attack. So it seems to me that this decision of, do we want to go and do something to push our geopolitical cause that might bear extraordinary, existential risk to our very existence? They've already answered that question in the affirmative, at least in my perception. Why in the world would you not think that they're going to do more extreme things?
Well, I think there's no doubt that Tehran is a broad backer of Hamas. I think there is still legitimate difference of opinion as the degree of culpability with this attack in particular. And I think that is the important kind of range of uncertainty that the policymakers are dealing with right now. And I think, even despite the hot rhetoric on all sides right now, I think it's been notable that at least the official statements from the White House and from the Israeli government and Tehran itself have all seemed to put distance between Iran and the Hamas attacks rather than tying them close together. And I think if we saw a eagerness on any side to escalate this, you would have seen that earlier on. Now, I think that you are gradually seeing conditions escalate regardless. I think that, once you remove, let's say you remove the direct culpability, I think that we're still in a kind of very, flammable situation, and things are only getting worse and things are only getting hotter. You're seeing various Iranian-backed proxy groups across the Middle East attacking Israel or U.S. forces with a whole variety of, missiles and drones and everything else. Obviously, you have seen that the United States, I want to say it was this past week, conducted airstrikes on two very clearly, Iranian Revolutionary Guard camps and ammunition bays in Syria that were being used to supply some of these broader attacks. But I think, again, I think you just haven't seen a willingness on any part to kind of directly tie Iran to the attacks, even if I think a lot of people, suspect it. But I think even the reporting on this has been very mixed. You saw early reports saying that, going as far as to say that Tehran actually greenlit the attacks a couple days prior, to the fact that, they were very surprised about the attacks, or at least the extent of the attacks. And I think what seems to be, and I think this is, very fog of war, no one knows right now. For me, my suspicion is that there was an idea that they were broadly supporting Hamas, that something was going to happen. But I think that the extent of the attack surprised Iran. And then that's just based off of the kind of very scattershot reporting that we're seeing so far. And I think if you wanted to escalate something more, I think you need something much more concrete than we have thus far. And I think for that reason, I think it's the same thing of, if Iran is going to escalate the crisis further, it's not going to be with direct Iranian forces. It's at least first going to be with its very, very voluminous and multifaceted, Iranian-backed proxy groups all throughout the region. That's been a core tenet of Iranian foreign policy in the region for decades now, is to not directly engage itself, but always to have this like dotted line plausible deniability. And I think it's going to be far more difficult to do something like mine the Strait of Hormuz with proxy forces. I think that's where you get the direct Iranian Navy involved, and then, all dotted line is out the door. And I think that's a direct confrontation. I think at this stage, it seems unlikely that anyone's going to take that move. But I don't disagree that the situation we are in certainly increases the likelihood that that happens. I think it still is just a tail risk, though.
Rory, let's move on to Venezuela, a country that you've been writing quite a bit about in commodity context lately. Also, an excellent source of the blend stock that we need, the heavy blend stock that's needed in order for U.S. refineries to be able to produce finished products from the crude oil that we produce in the United States. What's the story on Venezuela? How does that fit into this whole picture?
Yeah, and I think it's a really nice, you know, handoff here from discussing Iran, because I think the two countries in the world right now that are most, where supply is most directly constrained by some of the most severe U.S., you know, U.S. dollar secondary sanctions that we've ever seen in the market are on both Iran and Venezuela. And what we saw, I think, 2 weeks ago now is the Biden administration announced that it was removing or lifting primary oil sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry, on interactions and commercial interactions with PDVSA, Venezuela's national oil company, for, you know, 6 months. And in exchange for this, the Maduro government has at least ostensibly agreed to a bunch of these what they call this electoral roadmap. And the main goal here is, as stated by the Biden administration and by the State Department, is that they want to use the removal of these sanctions as a way of enticing and getting Maduro to agree to freer and fairer elections. The 2018 elections were generally considered to be, or I'm just going to say widely considered to be, corrupt and illegitimate. It had the lowest voter turnout in Venezuela's modern democratic history. And the hope is that the 2024, in early 2024, the Venezuelan presidential election will be less corrupt and more legitimate. So what you had seen was that the Maduro government and the unified opposition party group agreed to a couple things. And one important one was the inclusion of international independent observers in the election, which is a very common electoral transparency stipulation. And the other thing, importantly, was allowing all candidates that want to run for office to be allowed to run for office. And that's been a major thing that the Maduro government has done, is essentially invalidate people's candidacy. What you saw shortly after that was the opposition held a primary vote to figure out who was going to be this candidate to run against Maduro. And the overwhelming, I think the last time I saw it was 93% of the vote in the primary was achieved by a woman named Machado. And she is a longtime government opponent and, importantly, was previously invalidated from running for office in Venezuela by the Maduro government. And now the Maduro government has actually called that primary election to be a fraud and a sham, and are basically the supreme electoral authority is trying to invalidate it. So I think what we're seeing out the gate, barely, like not even a month into this, not even a couple of weeks into this, and you're already seeing the Maduro government kind of, you know, blow his nose towards this deal. Technically, the Maduro government has until the end of November to present the Biden administration with a concrete plan of action for doing two things. One, allowing all these candidates to run, including, I think most importantly, Machado. And second, beginning to release U.S. and Venezuelan political prisoners. I can see that second one happening faster. I think there's a real concern and I think real legitimate question of why would Maduro agree to something? Why would Maduro agree to an electoral stipulation at the gate where he is almost surely to lose in a much more public and transparent matter? And if anything, undermine his authority within the country. You know, while I'm initially optimistic and kind of commend the idea of, because again, sanctions for sanctions' sake, I don't think are that useful and are just punitive. I think the goal here is in the lifting of these sanctions in Venezuela, you create the carrot, which is your sanctions have been lifted, and you create the stick at the same time, which is we can immediately snap these back anytime we want should you run afoul of our agreement, which again, looks like at the gate Maduro is going to do. So I think that's a good policy use of these sanctions in an attempt to try and kind of leverage some concessions from the Maduro government so that you can begin to have some opposition, you know, gain traction there. But I think if you do see Maduro continue to oppose and prevent Machado from being on that ballot, the Biden administration doesn't reimpose those sanctions, I think it proves, in my humble opinion, that this is nothing more than attempt to get more oil in the market. And I think, obviously, we didn't even talk about it yet, but you know, I think that the potential upside for Venezuelan production from these sanctions easing is quite limited. I think we're probably talking somewhere in the ballpark of 200,000 to 300,000 barrels a day over the next kind of call it 6 months, which is, if we kind of relate this back to Iran, about half or less than half the potential downside to Iranian production from a tighter sanctions enforcement after the, you know, onset of the Israel-Hamas war. So I think it seems like a very little amount of crude for opening up your flank to, I think, very legitimate political attacks around kind of selling out in order just to get more crude in the market. I think that would be a shame for everyone. At most at this stage, it seems, you know, it seems the easing that this license that they've been granted is only 6 months. So at worst, right now, it's going to be 6 months. And then, you know, the Biden administration is going to end up with egg on its face. At best, you do see, you know, some actual movement. And while I supremely doubt an outright kind of like very natural and kind of civil, you know, election and movement to an opposition candidate from Maduro, I think they, you know, the hope is that they can at least make some electoral inroads. But to your point about the U.S. feedstock, I think, well, the 200 to 300,000 barrels a day is likely to, you know, it's not a huge amount in the context of an overall liquids balance, like we were talking at the beginning. It is, you know, and you're going to see even a larger volume than that shift into U.S. ports. And this is, again, heavier crude, very similar in quality. It's called Mary is the primary blend that Venezuela exports. Very similar to heavy sour Western Canadian Select, which has generally been in reasonably low supply, most notably because Saudi Arabia, in its unilateral cuts, has been withholding 2 million barrels a day from the market. And a lot of that has been medium to heavy sour crudes. So you have seen tightness there. And I think that has also gone, as we'll talk about a little bit later, I think, about this, you know, one of the things that we're seeing right now in the relatively lower diesel yields in global refineries, while we still have plenty of gasoline. And that's because those heavier sour barrels typically yield more diesel in the way that our refineries are configured.
We'll come back to gas and diesel cracks in just a minute. But first, I want to move on to OPEC Plus, because I'm going to admit I can't decide what would happen. Let's suppose that some version of my scenario happens, that there is a significant military, you know, Lindsey Graham gets his wish, and there is a U.S. attack on oil-producing resources in Iran. On one hand, it seems to me, at least as I'm reading the tea leaves here, I don't think that the other oil-producing nations are in any hurry to ally themselves with Iran. I don't think they want to join this fight. I think they would like this fight to go away. But at the same time, if you were to have a lot of civilian casualties in Iran and it was perceived as Israel was at war with the entire, you know, Muslim world, it would be very politically difficult for those OPEC plus countries to support the United States and effectively and indirectly support Israel by being accommodating with respect to, you know, OPEC increasing production in order to keep prices from getting out of control and so forth. How do you read that? What do you think OPEC would do in that scenario? And feel free to comment otherwise on OPEC.
So the one thing, and just kind of tying directly into this, and the one thing I had neglected and forgot to mention, I had mentioned earlier with the Israel-Hamas war, there were two main supply risks. And the one was Iran, and we discussed that at length. The other is Saudi Arabia. And I think that comes into this discussion very clearly because, you know, OPEC plus right now on paper is withholding 4 million barrels a day or more of supply from the market. In terms of realized actual barrels being withheld, not just under production and kind of chronic issues, probably closer to kind of 3, let's say. That's a lot of oil being withheld from the market, particularly when crude is kind of trending up around that $90 a barrel Brent threshold. That's, you know, normally you would not have the Saudis alone withholding 2 million barrels a day in that scenario. It just seems like a lot of supply support for that kind of tight market. One of the discussions and one of the major factors to watch and one of the hardest things to forecast, very frankly, is when Saudi Arabia decides to add more oil to the market. I would say it seems at this point they don't seem like they're in a huge hurry. They seem to be pretty happy with a backwardated market. They seem to be happy with the price levels, even as they kind of come under pressure here. But obviously, that even supports those cuts even more. But the one area that has been discussed as a reason for Saudi Arabia to lift or begin easing its cuts or lifting its production as part of a U.S. broker deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel to recognize, you know, for the Saudis to officially recognize Israel, the Saudis would get a U.S. defense pact renewed. And the Saudis have been discussing that if the market conditions allow, et cetera, they would begin lifting production in the first quarter of 2024, which, you know, does seem to dovetail pretty nicely with what I consider to be Mohammed bin Salman's far more kind of calculated and very self-interested politics of oil. And I think for him, it would be seen as a general win if you could kind of ease political conditions in the region and get a defense pact and kind of also get to increase production out of it as well. I think it's a very direct kind of lever and kind of holding in character there. But I think one of the things that one of the early theories as to the attacks from Hamas generally, and this would more directly implicate Iran, is that one of the countries with the most to lose of such a deal would be Iran, because Iran and Saudi Arabia, obviously historic adversaries in the region, obviously Iran and Israel, not great friends. So if Saudi Arabia and Israel got closer, that would be bad for Tehran. Obviously, if Saudi Arabia got a U.S. defense pact, that would be worse for Iran. And if Saudi Arabia increased production, that would be worse for Iran. So all of it's worse for Iran. So one of the things that was early discussed, and I think it seems like it might be a stretch now, but I think it makes sense structurally, is this idea that by attacking when they did on the eve of some of these negotiations, you essentially pressure and push the Saudis into at least delaying these negotiations, which is exactly what we've seen, that the official negotiations are now on pause. But I think one of the things that you could see here is if the Saudis say, like, look, if you tighten sanctions against Iran, then maybe, you know, then maybe we'll go back to the table with this supply offset, because maybe we want to produce more, but we want Iran to produce less. I think the way this dovetails into your scenario of, you know, a more direct assault against Iran. So the first thing is, I think you would get the direct loss of Iranian barrels. I think the question is, would the Iranian Navy attempt to completely militarize the Gulf, which would, I think, generally have a much larger barrel impact. But I think if it didn't, I think in your scenario, it was a little bit more contained, but it's just the question of, like, what does OPEC do? I think at this stage, OPEC is pretty clearly under the control of Saudi Arabia. And I think Saudi at this stage would seem pretty game, I think, to at least support the market so that Iran got hurt more in, you know, all else equal. So I think that's how I would think OPEC would deal with this. Because I think at this stage, OPEC to me seems mostly like an appendage of Saudi Arabia broadly, because of all the oil withheld from the market right now, actually a very small of it is officially withheld through OPEC, is withheld by this voluntary cuts that Saudi Arabia organized. And then 1 million barrels a day of it, or a third of it in total, is Saudi Arabia just itself, voluntary and unilateral. So I think that is something that Saudi wants to control this market, and they're very capable of controlling this market at this stage. And I think they would be very game to kind of put the pressure on Iran and be opportunistic in that way.
You mentioned a number of different countries and how many barrels they were each withholding. In terms of global spare capacity, what's your best guess? What's the total global spare capacity, defined not as stated numbers, but what you think the real number is? If everybody tried to produce as much as they possibly could after a couple of months to ramp up, how much would that be more than we have today?
I'd say probably ballpark, call it 3. Maybe 3.5 on the upside, with the vast majority of that existing in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. I think a lot of the rest of OPEC Plus, the paper cuts they have on the table right now, are mostly from just a general inability to produce that anyway. So it's mostly erasing these underperformance numbers than they are actually removing barrels from the market, all else equal. But I would say, yeah, let's say 3, 3.5. And I also think that's actually one of the reasons that even if markets are as tight as we were discussing at the beginning, I think a notable difference between the market we are in right now and the market we were in, let's say, last spring of 2022, was in 2022, the narrative was that OPEC was running out of spare capacity, shale was slowing down, then we're going to lose a huge amount of Russian supply. And it felt like, it's like, where could you possibly get more supply at a moment's notice? And the answer was essentially like nowhere, really. Now, I think if you did see a spike, let's say, to $110 a barrel Brent or $120, I think in that scenario, you would absolutely see the Saudis come back in with more supply to kind of satiate that tightness in the market. I don't think that the Saudis are anywhere near as dovish as they have been historically in pre-MBS. But I think that in the scheme of things, they still wouldn't like to see a complete kind of explosion of the crude price and damaging of economic outcomes right now, just given, I think, the general precarity of the broader macro setting.
I definitely agree that Saudi Arabia does not want to break the global market. But when you say 3.5, and I agree, that sounds like about the right number to me. If that's total spare capacity everywhere, then wait a minute. If I do agree that this is an outlier, even my base case is not this bad. But suppose that warmonger in chief Lindsey Graham has his way and the U.S. actually goes and tries to Senator Graham's words, knock Iran out of the oil business by destroying all of their oil-producing assets. Doesn't that take at least 3 million barrels offline, and doesn't that mean that all of the spare capacity is used up?
Effectively, yes. I think exports are slightly lower than that, but on a total supply basis, absolutely. And presumably in that scenario, you have a slightly lower impact, because in a scenario where you destroyed the entire Iranian industry, I assume that Iranian demand itself would also be slightly lower. But I do think net-net, yeah, I think ballpark, that's right. Which is why I think generally any outcome that involves the zeroing out of a major oil producer is going to be, you know, blazingly bullish. And I think that is something that just can't be avoided in any situation, because the oil market almost always in normal situations kind of trends around perfect balance, at least on a moving average multi-year basis. The hope is that, you know, you have stock builds here and there, but we're always pretty tight. So if you lose a huge chunk of supply, or in COVID case, a huge chunk of demand, the market really breaks really quickly. And I think in a situation where you had, you know, you removed, if Lindsey Graham got his way and you removed Iran from the oil business, yeah, that's going to, you know, there's a huge hole and no one can fill that, you know, very quickly.
Well, thank you for entertaining my admitted preoccupation with some of these. Everybody else calls them tail risks. I don't see them really as all that tail myself. Let's come back to something a little more mundane, which is actually it's not mundane. It's just not end of the world stuff, which is gas and diesel crack spreads. Normally, the system's pretty well balanced. We know how much gas and diesel we need. The gas and diesel crack spreads run fairly proportionate to one another. But lately, they're way out of whack. Why would they be so far out of whack?
Yeah. And so just for the very, very brief context there, before COVID, I call it normal times, the crack spread for diesel and gasoline typically ranged between 10 and 20 bucks a barrel, depending on the season, depending on whatever's going on in the market, but reasonably tight, reasonably similar. You know, earlier this year, both diesel and gasoline crack spreads were over $40 or $50 a barrel. Way, way, way kind of tighter than normal. And last year, we saw historic blowouts in both of those. I think at its peak, depending on the contract, you could get $70, $80 barrel crack spreads for certain diesel contracts. So very, very broken market coming out of COVID. Now, I think some of those refining capacity constraints are beginning to ease off a little bit as you see some of this new planned refining capacity come online that was delayed by COVID. But now we're seeing this other really interesting impact, and I think it's manifesting in large part from those OPEC Plus and particularly Saudi cuts. And understand why, if you look at Saudi Arabia as, let's just be super simple and say it is a 10 million barrel a day producer, ballpark, it produces a huge variety of blends of crude. It's not all one kind of monolithic grade. That's one of the things that makes Saudi Arabia so important in the oil industry, is it produces like a very wide array of crudes for different uses and different kind of feedstocks and different geographic regions that prefer it. So it's very well diversified on that. But when it cuts production, it typically is going to cut the least valuable barrels first. And those barrels typically tilt towards medium and heavier sour grades of crude, because those are typically more expensive to refine. But what you've seen over that period is the differentials for other grades of heavy crude have really, really narrowed. You have seen some of that ease off recently, but WCS is an example, the Western Canadian Select crude, which is the grade we typically have the most visibility on. That grade at the U.S. Gulf Coast went from, you know, near $20 a barrel differentials at the U.S. Gulf Coast earlier this year to nearly par this summer, and is back down to about $8 a barrel differential. Now, that's still reasonably tight for WCS, and I think it does show that the broader heavy sour crude market remains tight. And the reason this is important specifically for this refining conversation is that those heavier barrels, it's much easier to crack apart hydrocarbons than it is to fuse them together. So lighter crudes have a higher yield of lighter products like gasoline. That's why they're historically much more valuable. Heavier crudes, you have to refine more with a bunch more sophisticated and expensive refining infrastructure, things like these cokers that break up this heavy residual fuel oil into things like feedstock for diesel. And I think what you see here is if your overall crude slate becomes lighter, you know, your diesel yield, all else equal, you know, suffers. So what we're seeing right now, really interestingly, in the United States is a great example. Over the past couple months, let's say, over the preceding 18 months before that, you had both diesel and gasoline inventories tracing the very, very bottom of their normal seasonal ranges and supporting these really, really, really rich crack spreads. But then very suddenly, gasoline inventory shot higher from the bottom of the range, well past the average, and has kind of come back down around those averages, whereas diesel is still at the bottom. So what's happening, I think what you've seen is that while gasoline demand probably did weaken a little bit, and that's, I think, seasonally normal, the thing that's weird is that you had refining output kind of remain loftier than normal. And those refiners are chasing those still very lofty diesel spreads. And those diesel spreads now are at about, call it $40 a barrel, while gasoline is at about $5 right now on my screen. So huge collapse from gasoline went from $40 down to $5. And that's a screen crack spread. So the actual margin accounting for other costs likely means the gasoline margins are actually negative. That gasoline is effectively a cost byproduct now, whereas the diesel is holding up the entire structure of global refining margins. So because those refiners kept producing in order and kept running crude in order to satisfy that diesel demand, it ended up oversupplying the gasoline market at the same time, because one of the critical important things to understand about global refining is that you can't just produce one product. You have to process the barrel into all of its constituent products, which allows some of these, you know, blowouts and kind of dislocations in the market to become really extreme, because you can have products that normally yield a bunch of money, like gasoline, become effectively worthless, if not actually like negative valued byproducts.
Seems to me like that's a really good topic to drill further into. We don't really have time on this interview, but maybe in some of your future writing. It seems to me for energy transition, one of the things I expect to have happen is diesel demand stays around for a long time, because it takes much longer to replace the heavy equipment that burns diesel. But gasoline demand is likely to come down substantially as electric vehicles become more popular. As you said, you can't just turn a valve and say, oh, we're going to take this crude oil and produce all diesel with it, no gasoline. Doesn't work that way. So what's going to happen in this energy transition to all the gasoline?
I think it's a huge topic and something that's been dreadfully misunderstood and undercovered. Now, I think one of the important things to note is that historically, we actually have already had periods where gasoline was a worthless byproduct. At the beginning of the oil industry, back when, you know, J.D. Rockefeller ruled the market, you had these, and this is before the onset of the automobile age. Initially, oil was produced for kerosene, for lamps, to displace whale oil. And gasoline, which was way too volatile and explosive for use in these types of uses, was essentially, I've seen photos of it, they used to pour it onto lakes and set it on fire. So we actually...
flaring it off, just like we flare off natural 100%, gas. We don't know what to do.
Exactly, 100%. So I think, you know, that's an extreme case, obviously, and doesn't seem particularly ESG these days. But I think more likely what you'd see is that as gasoline came under more and more pressure, I think we'd find other uses for it. And I think gasoline is a light hydrocarbon. I think we'd figure out ways to put it into petrochemical feedstock. But I do think that it is an area for a lot more research, and I'll be writing a lot more about refining over the next couple of months.
Well, Rory, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, but I want to stick on that subject of what you're writing in the next couple of months. Tell us more about Commodity Context. This is a really cool website that most people have never heard of. How did it come about? What's there? What services do you offer? And how can people follow your work?
So you can look at commoditycontext.com, where all my research is hosted. It's a Substack platform. I write twice a week right now, typically, alternating between I have a weekly note that I publish every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern. I alternate between thematic research, some of my recent Venezuela work, and these data decks, which is these broader balance estimates and stuff as well. And the one thing I will finally say, because I know that, Eric, you'll not forgive me if I not mention it before we go, is obviously a lot of the work I've done on here over the past little while is around the SPR.
I forgot to ask you. We ran out of time. You know, we got to let you just do a real quick 60 seconds of the SPR, because they'll shoot us.
Exactly. So I think what we've seen recently, and the most notable recent move, is that the White House and the Department of Energy has actually changed the way that they're soliciting for refills on the SPR now. And they're actually doing a rolling period. So each month they're looking at purchasing like 3 million barrels if the price of WTI is below $79 a barrel, which at the time they announced it was over 90. So I think, you know, it got a lot of side eye at the time, but I think it is at least a better version than these single one-off pilots that they were attempting. And I think it shows that they're gradually starting to figure out how to do this. But I think what we've seen so far is that they still have not managed to really pull it off. And I think that it is also surely part of this announcement, the way it was announced, following the onset of the Israel-Hamas war, and the kind of the sheer barrage of, I think, very negative media that the White House has received, particularly in the context of the 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War and the Arab oil embargo in 73. I think all that together really pushed them to kind of reprioritize and recenter the refill on their agenda. And they're going to get a little further. But the other final important thing I'll mention here is that at most, they can only probably purchase something in the order of 50 million barrels, because they only have something around $4 billion left ballpark in the actual SPR or the crude oil account. All the rest of that money has been remitted back to Congress. And if Congress is going to want, and particularly as the politics of this get hotter, if Congress is going to want the White House to refill more SPR, they're going to need to allocate more funds. And I think they should do that ahead of time, so that we're not bickering over the price and getting the money in line. If, let's say, we actually do have, let's say, some kind of economic crisis, not outside the realm of possibility right now, and crude oil prices do fall, I think obviously it would be a great opportunity to buy when prices are lower.
Listeners, once again, the website is commoditycontext.com. Rory didn't mention it, but his Twitter handle, which I follow very closely, is Rory_Johnston. That's Johnston with a T in it, not Johnson. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com. Energy Transition Crisis, my new video documentary series about energy transition, has finally been released, and anyone can watch it for free at energytransitioncrisis.org. The series explains exactly what it's really going to take to break humanity's addiction to fossil fuels and why it will take longer and cost more than almost anyone realizes. And I'd like to think the three episodes on nuclear energy are among the most detailed on YouTube. This is a passion project for me, and there's no profit motive, no revenue, and therefore no budget other than donations. I'd really appreciate your help promoting the series. Things you can do to help include subscribing to the Energy Crisis Doc YouTube channel, liking every episode, posting comments on YouTube, and posting links to your favorite episodes on social media. If you don't have time to do those things, there's also a donations page at energytransitioncrisis.org. The money does not go to me. 100% of it will be spent on YouTube and other social media advertising to promote the series. Thanks in advance for your help. Now let's get back to the show and Patrick's post-game chart deck.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Rory back on the show. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Rory's picture that says looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's get to crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a build of 774,000 barrels this week, Cushing, Oklahoma building 272,000 barrels, gasoline building 65,000 barrels, distillates was the only drawdown on the board at 792,000 barrels, while U.S. production held unchanged at 13.2 million barrels. So needless to say, that big Q3, Q4 massive drawdowns of, 20 million barrels a week, well, we actually got a build this week, so it's not happening the way analysts thought it was going to go down this summer, at least not in the EIA data. Israel moved forward with ground operations in Gaza this week and suffered some casualties from Hamas. That could have the potential to escalate the intensity of Israel's ground invasion. Meanwhile, the United Nations warned of rapidly escalating risk of this conflict growing into a broader regional war. Then both Tehran and Moscow made statements warning of the risk of further escalation if Israel escalates its operations. Crude oil sold off by a full $5 on the news as of Wednesday's close. So the message from the market is crystal clear. The market no longer perceives any serious risk of this conflict escalating in a way that could threaten global oil supply. They're not worried about Iran closing or mining the Straits of Hormuz. They're not worried about Iran keeping its promise to escalate to a direct war with Israel if the IDF makes a ground invasion of Gaza, which is already occurring right now. And they're not the slightest bit worried about Senator Lindsey Graham making good on his threat to use military force to destroy Iran's oil-producing and refining assets as retribution for Iran keeping their promise to escalate if the IDF does what it's already doing. So far as I can tell, none of these things are perceived by anyone other than me as a serious upside risk to oil prices. In addition to Dr. Anas Al-Haji and Ola Hansen and now Rory Johnston, who have disagreed with me here on Macro Voices, I had the opportunity this week off the air to discuss my views with two other very highly respected voices in the crude oil market, and they both agreed with our recent guests and disagreed with my view that there's still a very high risk of oil supply threat escalation in this conflict. They all seem to be confident that Iran would never be stupid enough to risk its very existence by escalating this conflict while the U.S. has two aircraft carrier battle groups and several guided missile destroyers and cruisers on station in the region for the purpose of deterrence. Now, to be sure, their view made money in the market this week, and my view lost money. We've now broken briefly below the continuation 100-day moving average on WTI and came within a few ticks of the contract 100-day moving average. And on Wednesday, we retested the October 6th low on WTI. That was the day before the Hamas assault on the Rave in Israel. So all the geopolitical risk premium has now retraced completely, as the market signals what I think is a remarkable complacency that the risk of this conflict affecting the oil market is pretty much over at this point. In discussing this with one very prominent market expert this week, I heard the first counterargument that really made me think hard. When he asked me what I'm so worried about, I said, I think this conflict is part of a much bigger trend. First, we had the Russia-Ukraine situation threatening the global world order, now Israel-Hamas, and to my thinking, it's only a matter of time before some sort of conflict arises between China and Taiwan. I told him that while I could be persuaded that maybe Iran might be smart enough not to retaliate while the U.S. has half of its military arsenal pointed directly at them, I'm still confident that they won't forget this event and that they'll retaliate in due time, once again risking a U.S.-Iran military conflict that could lead to Iran at least trying to mine the Straits of Hormuz, and if Senator Lindsey Graham gets his wish, that could lead to the United States completely eliminating all Iranian oil supply, which would consume all of global spare capacity, per Rory Johnston's numbers in today's feature interview. The part of his response that caught me off guard and really made me think was when he said that he agreed with me that China-Taiwan is a very serious risk on the future event radar, but then he went on to explain why he saw that as potentially being massively bearish, not bullish, oil prices. He explained that China could blockade the global shipping traffic through the South China Sea and literally shut down global trade, which could have the same effect on the global economy as the pandemic had. Now, he also acknowledged the counter argument that it could also lead everyone to hoard oil, which would be bullish. His real point was that it could go either way, and it would be foolish to assume that geopolitical conflict always equates to higher oil prices. That gave me something to think about while we wait for the next chapter of this fourth turning to unfold. Returning to the present conflict, I still think there's way too much complacency in the system, and I also think that many Western analysts are misinterpreting some aspects of this situation. For example, I heard a couple of analysts this week mention that Saudi Arabia has already committed to increasing production and exports in order to ease concerns arising out of the present conflict. Look, that's simply not true. What Saudi Arabia actually said was that if this conflict escalates in a way that threatens global oil supply and results in a runaway upside excursion in oil prices, then the kingdom would respond by increasing production and exports as much as possible to help stabilize the market. That's nowhere close to the same as saying that they already committed to increase production. To the contrary, we're almost back down to $80 Brent, the level Dr. Anas Al-Haji said he would expect OPEC Plus to defend. So if the market keeps selling off on what I think is excessive complacency, we should expect Saudi Arabia and OPEC to cut production, not to increase it. And quite frankly, I don't mind saying that I think Western traders are being unduly influenced by misleading propaganda. The Biden administration would have you believe that the Saudis and OPEC Plus are an evil price cartel that we should see as an enemy because it's thanks to them that we have such high gasoline prices. I couldn't possibly disagree more strongly. I applaud the Saudis for their commitment to restoring spare capacity in the global market, which is exactly what the world desperately needs right now, so that if one of the several formative wars that we have on the radar screen does take several million barrels of supply off the market suddenly, it will be possible to tap that spare capacity in order to avert a global oil price crisis that could exacerbate the underlying military conflicts even farther. So as far as I'm concerned, the Saudis are the grown-ups on the oil stage right now, and it's the Biden administration's reckless draining of the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve, just as a serious global conflict was starting between Russia and Ukraine. Now that's what I think should be condemned as threatening both the economic and physical safety of the American people. OPEC Plus and Saudi Arabia are the heroes in this story, not the villains. They're working hard to restore spare capacity to the system in case we need it, which I think we eventually will.
Eric, on page two, I have that crude oil futures chart for the December contract. And obviously, we've been in a deep correction over the last month as we put in those highs in the mid-90s and have been correcting down toward $80 here. To me, this is actually a very interesting moment. All of the highs of 2023 in the first half of the year were more or less established in the $80 area. So now, as we correct back, you can see the 200-day moving average lying there. This is an interesting area where one would think that oil would find support. And it'll be interesting to see whether a short-term viable bottom comes in here, especially if the whole market is temporarily going risk on. It might give an opportunity for crude oil to reverse. Will it break to new highs? Will it go to 100? Those are early speculations. But at this moment, it'll be interesting to see whether the short-term low comes here and whether we get to the mid to high 80s here in response to that. And moving on, though, to equities, what are you thinking here on the markets, Eric?
I think we're at a very important make-or-break moment for the S&P as we flirt with retaking the 200-day moving average. We've been in a very clear downtrend for the last several weeks, but as I've said before, the usual pattern when a war breaks out is that at first traders panic and they sell everything because a war broke out. Then they calm down, take a deep breath, and think it through. And then they remind themselves that wars are always inflationary and involve lots and lots of government spending, which usually brings about a full recovery in the stock market, led by defense stocks. I think that's probably what's happening now, and a solid move above 4,300 on the S&P would be the first confirmation. The next confirmation would be retaking the 100-day moving average at 44.31, and above that level, 46.12 is the next upside target. But the question is whether the recent weakness was war-related or just because the most anticipated recession of all time really is going to collapse demand. And if that's the case, this could just be a dead cat bounce off a badly oversold technical market. What happens here at the 200-day moving average should give the tell on the next leg.
Yeah, I want to comment on those moving averages in a second, but I want to get Nick into this conversation. Nick, on the S&P 500, what levels are you watching?
Spot price right now, Patrick, is approximately 4240 on SPX. We have a call wall above at 4300 and a put wall below at Friday's support area of 4100. The implied move for the November 17th OPEX is plus minus 105 points. The upper expected move is 43.45, and the lower expected move is 41.35, just above that support area and that put wall. Key resistance right now is just above at 42.50, then 4,300, and key support is now at 4,200, then 41.50. As we discussed last week, I thought we'd see perhaps a dead cat bounce toward the 4,300 mark area, and we saw a pullback all the way down to 4,100, bounce off that pretty fast, and As we speak right now, we're almost at 4,300. So that's transpired. Apple has earnings tonight. Powell spoke yesterday, and he was pretty bullish overall on the economy. So that may pave the way for a late end of year rally, perhaps.
Nick, I like to look at a little bit bigger picture. You know, when you look back to the October 2022 low, we had a 1,000 S&P point rally into July. And what we really witnessed up to this point was about a 500 point pullback. So it's about a 50% retrace or give back of the previous rally in that bigger picture. And we were quite oversold, by a lot of metrics. There was no shortage of technicians and other quant people out there talking about these very oversold conditions. 4,100 was a level that we were watching and talked about on the show numerous times in the weeks prior. And we're getting a bounce. But by no means am I ready to already, turn bullish just because we were oversold and the market reacts the other way. It is not enough for me to suddenly say, oh, now 4,600's on the table. I know this is certainly possible, but in my view, we have incredibly tight financial conditions, and the old adage is don't fight the Fed. I mean, we are now in a scenario where the Fed is pausing because they've already tightened the conditions, and that's not typically an environment where a new bull phase occurs. And so to me, 4,300 right around this area is a fib bounce. It'll be interesting to see whether or not the bulls can follow through this area, because if you look back to the August market rally and then subsequently the late September rally, each one of them was just under 200 S&P point bounces. They each lasted just under 2 weeks, and each time the market rolled over. And so I want to first see what happens now that we're bouncing. It looks very similar to rallies of the past, bounces of the past anyway, and we're going to see whether or not the market reacts here and fails. I think if the bulls continue to work a little bit on this and the dollar backs off, maybe we'd see 4,400 or something like that. But I'm not overly bullish beyond this bouncing a little bit higher. Nonetheless, let's move on to the NASDAQ. Obviously, Apple earnings is going to influence this, but at least what are the levels you're watching?
Spot price right now on Qs is 359 approximately. We have a call wall above at 380 and a put wall below at 345. Now, the implied move for the November 17th OPEX is plus minus 12 points. So the upper potential move would be 371, and the lower potential move would be 347. A key resistance right now is just above at 360, and key support is just below at 355. As you just mentioned on S&P, I see it kind of the same way a little bit in terms of, you know, we had a significant decline over the last couple of weeks. I think the S&P and the NASDAQ were both down about 7% roughly, and now we've bounced about 4%. So again, short term, I do see a bit of a bounce toward around the 375, 380 mark perhaps on Qs. But that's where I'd be hesitant to add to longs. What I am looking at, however, is the small caps, which on the Russell, the IWM, was trading near 160 and your lows. And now it's trading at around 167 or so. I'm more bullish on small caps simply because they've been so decimated and they're down over 20% from the highs. Again, a pair trade may make sense perhaps where you go short big tech and long small caps, because again, I do think small caps will outperform in the short term.
Nick, let's move on to page 6, where we have the volatility index. And while we did see a rise in volatility, I'm actually a bit surprised that we didn't sustain a period above 20 a little bit longer. What is also really interesting is how quickly volatility has backfilled. I mean, we are back to the 16 handle on the VIX, suddenly vol premiums are once again reasonably priced. And that happened very quickly. It'll be interesting to see whether or not we revisit the previous lows. I'm actually a bit of a seller because I think the summer lows were a period of very low realized volatility, and I don't think we're necessarily going back to that. So maybe this 15-16 level might be the bottom end of the range. How do you interpret it?
So the VIX right now is at around 16, which denotes that we should have about 1% broad movements in the S&P daily. That's a top-to-bottom move. Again, it was surprising to see us pull back from that 20 level as Powell spoke. But as we see the markets rally back up and we see demand for out-of-the-money options decline, that's where you see the VIX go down. And right now, yesterday, for example, we saw a lot of volume on the short term, that being the zero DTE call options. We haven't seen substantial call buying out of the money for longer dated options, which is what would drive the VIX a bit higher, perhaps, as well as puts. So I think we're going to stay between 16 and 17, perhaps, over the next couple of weeks. But after that November OPEX is what I'm going to look for to see if we pop back up toward 20 or if we die back down to 12-ish on a end of year rally. Now, moving on to the US dollar index on page 7, what are your thoughts here?
Still in the consolidation range between 105 and 107, and as of today, we've been in that consolidation pattern for a full month now. I fear that this will resolve to the upside, and if it does on a measured move basis, the next target appears to be at least 113. That could get ugly for risk assets, and I think it will happen if we get the big escalation in geopolitical risk that nobody other than me seems to be worried about. And frankly, since nobody other than me seems to be worried about it, that means they're not hedged for it either. And that means if that upside move does happen when nobody's hedged for it, it could accelerate very quickly.
Yeah, the dollar has certainly found a short-term high along this 107. It looked like it could potentially have broken out. The yen was the U.S. dollar yen was breaking out to a higher high, which I also have a chart on here. But now, obviously, after the Powell comments, the dollar backing off a little bit. I don't think it changes anything for the dollar. I mean, can we see a dollar gravitate back toward its 200-day moving average? We see 105, 104.50 as the euro bounces a little bit. That can happen, but I don't think that changes my overall view of what is going to happen to the dollar. I think all buy-on dips can occur on that kind of a pullback, and inevitably the dollar is probably destined for a trip back to 2022 levels up higher, and that's currently where at least I stand on this. So it'll be interesting to see how deep this pullback is before the buy-on dip emerges.
Now moving on to page 8, we have the gold futures chart. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
This week saw three red candles in a row on the daily chart, and that was for the first time since the market bottomed at 1825 over a month ago. That says to me that the gold market is breathing a sigh of relief, one that I think is misplaced, because they think the Israel-Hamas conflict is going to de-escalate rather than escalate from here. So gold is reflecting what we're already seeing in the crude oil market. Nobody but Eric is worried about this thing escalating substantially from here. If there really is no escalation and Israel wraps up its military operations without any more escalation, then at least a 50% retrace back down to 1900 or so is entirely plausible. But so far, all we've seen is a textbook pullback back down to the 13-day moving average, the lowest of the three short-term moving averages. And that unto itself is nothing but a healthy correction in a bull trend. But a daily close below 1980 could lead to a very rapid retracement back down to 1940 or so, especially if war risk is abating. Personally, I'm not taking profits, and I'm holding my gold longs because I still think the risk is much higher than others perceive. But for now, I seem to be alone in that view, which means I'm preparing myself for what could be a very significant pullback in gold before the bull market resumes.
Well, Eric, you know, for me, first of all, what was rather surprising was the fact that gold rallied while the U.S. dollar was rallying throughout the past month. And now with the U.S. dollar's pulling back, the question is, will that act as a tailwind? Obviously, geopolitics are a factor. Obviously, rates are a factor. But overall, you know, the bigger move in gold is likely to happen, in my mind, during an easing cycle. And so to me, what would be the most interesting thing would be if gold managed to stay up here in the 2000s for an extended period of time, you know, go up to 2050, pull back to 2000, trade in that range, establish a new higher level that is sustaining above the 200-day moving average, that could really set up for a very bullish 2024. It'll be really interesting to see how the bulls can defend this during a consolidation phase. Nonetheless, I want to move on to a few other charts. On page 9, I have the U.S. U.S. 30-year government bonds. And, you know, we showed the 2-year last week, and it was interesting that Stanley Druckenmiller was talking about taking big positions in the 2-year. But the 30-year as well is bouncing. And while it's hard to make an argument that we're going to see much lower yields and a huge rip higher without there being, let's say, a huge recession or something of that sort. But if you look back through the November 2022 through to December, January of 2023, we had bonds bounce from a very oversold condition and gravitate back to the 200-day moving average. It'll be really interesting to see whether we're establishing a short-term low and whether we just simply get a reactionary rally from just a very oversold condition. This could alleviate a lot of the stresses on the market as rates back off, which could feed the risk-on impulse a little bit on the interim. It'll be interesting to see whether that short-term bottom is there. And finally, on page 10, I have the U.S. dollar-yen. We already talked about the U.S. dollar, but what was interesting here is the U.S. dollar-yen popped above that 150 overhead resistance on the Bank of Japan and approached 152, which was a measured move target on the upside that I was talking about with members for a while. The interesting thing will be, will the bulls be able to hold that US dollar above 150? One of the things that mark some sort of a short-term top and a mean reverting correction would be if we dropped back below 150 and stayed there for a couple days or even a week, because that could open the window for a pullback to 148 to 146, which would contribute to the dollar index heading back to 105 or 104.50. Will we see this US dollar yen putting in a little pop and drop along this high is certainly something I think all listeners should be watching for.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, including a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.